The next case is 05-398, Disciplinary Counsel versus Michael Troy Watson. Mr. Watson.
Good morning, Your Honor.
I have the pleasure of addressing the Supreme Court today, and I thank you very much for having this opportunity. I really appreciate it. I'd like to say that I'm very happy to be before you, Justice O'Donnell. You have seen me before in trial court in Cuyahoga County, and I've known you for years since my days of being in the Ripon Club, and I appreciate having the opportunity to speak with you this morning. Justice Stratton, this is my first opportunity to be before you. Justice Resnick was here the last time I was here. Chief Justice, thank you very much for this opportunity. Justice Pfeiffer, who had the question on the issue of whether or not being contrite and remorseful was an element. The last time I was here, it will come up again today, Justice Pfeiffer. Justice O'Connor, pleasure to be before you this morning. And Justice Lanziger, this is my first opportunity. Your Honors, I'm sure you're familiar with all that's been filed in this case. I've spent 20 years of my life practicing law in the county of Cuyahoga in the state of Ohio and the district of Washington, D.C. 20 years until just recently. Never before has this Supreme Court ever made the determinations that have been done in this case. Never before. In over 20 years of unblemished, uninterrupted practice, I've been over hundreds of jury trials, hundreds. 70-plus Court of Appeals actions, and at least half a dozen either attempts or presentations of attempts to the Supreme Court. Your Honors, I'm here to defend both myself and the integrity of this court, the integrity of precedent, the integrity of policy. How is it that in the first case, which is used as mitigation here, I have a full investigation before the Cleveland Bar Association, who exonerates me entirely, and yet the Cuyahoga County Bar re-prosecutes the identical grievance, written by the same attorney and the same parties, and then brings me before this panel without giving me an opportunity to have the first panel hear the testimony from Cleveland Bar Association. It was all excluded. Even the decision of the Cleveland Bar Association was quashed. The subpoena of the records of Cuyahoga County Bar Association were all quashed. I had to go forward. And not a single client witness testified against me, Your Honors. Not one. But I was found guilty beyond the standard required of clear and convincing, without not a single witness testifying against me. How did this get to the second case? It is the same disciplinary counsel and the same determinations that go forward in the second case, while the first one is pending. Your Honor is unblemished for almost 20 years, until the Cuyahoga County Bar overrules the Cleveland Bar. Never happened before in the history of the Supreme Court, ever. Yet when the disciplinary counsel takes the position, Your Honors, that they will exonerate, as a good example, Mr. Reggie Maxton, totally exonerated for actions he took with his client so long as he testified it was my client, and it never was. The client never testified. Never. Never. How is it that I'm here? I'm even prosecuted for acting as Watson and Watson with my father, who's retired but an active lawyer. I'm prosecuted for that. This new case, the disciplinary counsel had its own policy and issued it specifically, stating that when there's litigation pending, we don't proceed. No, but Mike Watson is different. For whatever basis, the Cuyahoga County Bar Association and Disciplinary Council felt that I should be punished. And, Your Honors, I do want to reserve 10 minutes for my reply.
Watch your time there.
Whatever reason that the Disciplinary Council felt that I had to be castigated, I had to be disciplined, even the generation of grievances against me, met with no consideration whatsoever. In the examination of this panel, I'm castigated for being remorseful, Justice Pfeiffer, remorseful and contrite, but not remorseful and contrite enough when I'm arguing my own case. This was, in my opinion, I think, an attack upon me. Does that matter? No, it is the integrity of law that I think is important here. Not just what I want, and of course, I lost my practice. Six lawyers, one of the largest black firms in Ohio, all black firms, 13 employees, millions of dollars recovered on behalf of clients, thousands of clients. I lost my license for a year when a client's check bounced and I didn't show up in court. And then they piled on the other elements, including an opinion that had never been disseminated. It was not a disciplinary rule. But when I recorded someone who threatened me physically, I was castigated and disciplined severely. I'm here before this panel, literally begging this panel. And I'm telling you, please, I am begging this panel for my reinstatement to the practice of law. I mean, look at this last decision. The disciplinary council comes in and a good example, accuses me of being anti-Semitic. What the has that got to do with any of the issues before the panel? The disciplinary council states that some parties were alleged that I told them to come to court and lie. Of course, there's nothing could be farther from the truth. But he has taken that position, Your Honors, without a single witness. I can't even call him. I have exonerating witnesses, Bruce Hodge and Yvonne Harris, who were issued subpoenas, acknowledged the receipt of subpoenas, and thumbed their nose at the panel, did not appear. And with Ms. Harris, she had been in contact with the disciplinary council at all times. In fact, had been prosecuted by the disciplinary council and has never appeared even today to explain why she just simply didn't show up and explain why her name was on that check.
Mr. Watson, I've read with great caution all of the material you provided to us.
Yes, Your Honor.
But in the last analysis, as I understand the import of the case presented, your license had been suspended on May 22nd of 2002, and since that time, you have met with clients, accepted legal fees, conducted business with opposing counsel, and provided legal advice to numerous clients. And it is basically, as I understand the case of disciplinary counsel, your continued practice of law in contravention of your license suspension, which is at the core of their argument.
Your Honor, I would agree. It is the core of their argument, and it simply is not so. If you just simply...
Your position is that that is not true.
Not only is it not true, Your Honor, if you examine the testimony of the witnesses, not a single one of them establishes that. For a good example, they're talking about Nadine Turner in one instance. Nadine Turner never filed a grievance against me, ever. She had no issue as against me. It stirred up in an issue and originating with Judge Satula from the bench. She filed it, but Judge, let's just get to the reality of that. The reality is Mr. Goines, who had his employees seek to have answers to interrogatories prepared, when the lady didn't reply to him, didn't respond to him, didn't respond to him, asked me if I could get the answers. Look at what Mr. Goins said exactly. I wrote down her responses. He wrote and completed the interrogatories. He had his secretary type them. And, Your Honor, this Supreme Court has already made a determination as to what consists of the practice of law. And that's not it.
On the Turner case, on June 17th, it's alleged that you met with Turner and signed a contract, a settlement agreement with her, and she signed it and you did, and there's evidence of that. And on September 6th, you met with her and assisted her in preparing responses to interrogatories, and there's evidence of that. And on September 6th, you contacted opposing counsel, Mr. Wagner, to discuss that case, and there's evidence of that.
Make sure it's clear, Your Honor. It's much more than that.
Well,
see, first, Your Honor.
Let me understand something.
And it's not.
If in fact there is some evidence that you had conducted this legal representation, is that not practicing law during the suspension period?
That's just it, Your Honor. The court has established clear and convincing evidence. You've already made that decision as to what that consists of. The court has already said what the practice of law consists of.
Yes.
And, Your Honor, is there any bar from Mr. Michael Goins, the attorney on the case, asking me to go out and get the answers to the interrogatories and bring them back to him? I didn't type them. I didn't rephrase them. I did nothing but write down what she said and report it to Mr. Goins. And if you look at his testimony, Your Honor, it says exactly that. At his request, I went out there.
So, counsel, what you're saying here is that all this activity that you admitted that you did with these various clients does not rise to the level of practicing law. You were merely pursuing activities, no matter how you characterize them. They weren't, by your definition, practicing law in light of a suspension issued by this court. Is that accurate?
I want to be very specific to the justice, Your Honor. If a practicing attorney on a case asked me to go out and seek answers and then in court testifies specifically that he made such a request of me as he did under oath, how am I in the unauthorized practice of law?
I just want to be clear, counsel, that your statement, your position here, is this host of activities that are mentioned in the disciplinary proceedings, in your view, does not rise to the level of practicing law.
Your Honor, it is not my view that I advocate here. It is the view of this Supreme Court that has already made such a determination as to what consists of the practice of law. This other element, Your Honor, I receive a phone call on my cell phone and press an unknown button and call it back. It turns out it's Kent Mitchell. I have no client. I have not discussed a client. There's testimony and evidence that the client was represented by Attorney James Lee at all times. Yet I'm in the practice of law for responding to a call to Kent Mitchell, who happened to be a member of the Cuyahoga County Grievance Committee at the time. Why is this something that I'm charged with practice of law? The Supreme Court has defined it and has never said at one time that returning a blind phone call is the practice of law. It's never said compiling the answers to interrogatories at the direction of another attorney that he has sworn to under oath, Your Honors.
Mr. Watson, what
is the practice of law?
What about the allegations of retainers being paid? Are you denying that you did? Are you saying that you never received these funds that are alleged to have been paid to you by various individuals? You never received any of it?
Well, no, I never said that, Judge. Let's get to the correct element of it. In one instance, I received a basic retainer that this Supreme Court says when you are doing employment law, you can get an investigative retainer. And I received a retainer that I did prepare and exhaust. And the client security fund investigated it fully and exonerated me entirely. Yet I'm here before this panel on the same accusation twice. I go before the client security fund. They say, Watson, you did nothing wrong. Yet I still have to be before this Justice Department, this honorable justice is here, defending my legal life. Your Honors, After 20 years of practice, hundreds of trials, millions of dollars recovered, the largest, one of the largest, black firms in Ohio, I was then nominated by Governor Taft for a judicial position. In the midst of that, up comes this. I have been out of practice for 3 years. I have been through bankruptcy court, Your Honors. I have lost all of my income property, 10 buildings. I have lost my personal residence. I have nothing. And is that not enough? Is that not enough for this type of situation? Is it not enough?
Counsel, the work that that you did do was under the supervision of what attorney?
G. Michael Goins. He testified to that very specifically. This issue of Kent Mitchell's blind call. I can't believe this. I get a blind call about a case. Look at Mr. Abraham's testimony. Mr. Lee represented him. Look at Mr. Lee's testimony. Mr. Lee represented him. And it had nothing to do with what Mitchell said. Some building in North Homestead had nothing to do with any of that. I did not practice law in that aspect. I did not, Your Honor. I have complied with what is necessary. I did, Your Honor. And how is it that when I have the counterclaims that I present for information, the motions that I presented for information, for all of the other elements that I presented for demand of information, it has been denied in every element.
You've used your time, Mr. Watson. Mr. Berger.
May it please the court, Robert Berger for Relator, Office of Disciplinary Counsel. This morning, Relator requests this honorable court disbar respondent Michael Troy Watson. There are five grounds for this request. First, the record is full of countless examples of respondents' pervasive and persistent dishonesty. And this is dishonesty with clients, with other attorneys, with Relator while conducting the investigation, and with the hearing panel. Of the 12 counts in the disciplinary complaint heard by the panel, respondent was found to have engaged in dishonest or deceptive conduct in 10 of those counts.
Counsel, could I stop you for a minute? Because it was unclear to me what witnesses did appear before the panel. And we heard Mr. Watson say that none of these individuals actually appeared to give testimony. And I'm looking here at the various filings. I want to make sure that we know exactly what was appropriately before the panel when they made the findings they made.
Mr. Watson, Mr. Berger is at the podium.
Certainly, Your Honor. I believe Mr. Watson was referring to his claim of no witnesses in the first case. In the case that was heard at hand, every client testified, as well as opposing counsel and other witnesses, and in some cases, attorneys who handled the case after respondent was suspended. So in each case, the client testified with regard to Mr. Watson's activities. The second ground for requesting that respondent be disbarred is his repeated practice of law while under suspension. Of the 12 counts heard by the board, they found respondent engaged in the practice of law in 6 of those counts after he was ordered suspended by this court. The third grounds is respondent's continuous neglect of his clients and his failure to cooperate in the disciplinary process. Respondent was found to have neglected 5 different clients, and there were 4 counts in which he was found to have failed to cooperate with Relator during the investigation. The fourth reason for disbarment, this is respondent's third appearance before this court. And if you take a look at the court's prior decisions and the board's prior recommendations, you will see respondent has continued to engage in the same kind of misconduct throughout each of these disciplinary cases. Additionally, respondent mentioned a moment ago, he's been practicing for 20 years with an unblemished record. The record in all 3 disciplinary cases show that he's been engaging in misconduct since at least 1996, which would mean for at least the past 10 years he's been engaging in the same type of misconduct that brings us here today.
Counsel, if I understand the respondent's arguments, and I may misinterpret them, some of this conduct that's involved here is redundant with what was involved in the last case. In other words, they were in play or the same or similar kinds of violations, that these are not matters that have occurred subsequent to him, to his last appearance here. And then secondly, with respect to engaging in practice while under suspension, he makes a claim, I believe, that whatever activities he was engaged in, he was in the role of a legal assistant or someone not engaged in the practice of law. And with respect to that, I do believe it is not uncommon for lawyers under suspension or even disbarred lawyers to be employed by other lawyers to do non-legal practice kinds of things because they have good skill levels at doing that. So I've asked you several questions. But
certainly, Your Honor. Yeah. I'll address those in order.
Sure.
First, with regard to the respondent's misconduct, the misconduct in this case occurred between 1999 and 2002. After respondent was suspended, his misconduct continued, but the misconduct that continued after the suspension fell into two categories, well, three categories. First, he continued to practice law, and I'll address that further. Second, he failed to cooperate in the disciplinary process. And third, he engaged in deceitful and dishonest conduct as found by the board throughout the disciplinary investigation and the disciplinary hearing. With regard to your second inquiry about the practice of law, Mr. Watson has suggested that he was simply working for Mr. Goins, who was subsequent counsel for Nadine Turner. The record shows Mr. Watson advised Nadine Turner there would be another attorney coming in to assist him, and she should not speak to this second attorney, Mr. Goins, until Mr. Watson introduced them. Mr. Watson never introduced them, and Nadine Turner had no interaction with Mr. Goins until she met him at a show cause hearing. In between the time that Mr. Watson was suspended and the show cause hearing, Mr. Watson continued to be the primary communication with Nadine Turner, and he met with her both to complete the interrogatories. He contacted opposing counsel. There was another matter, the settlement agreement, which was a legal malpractice lawsuit that the respondent was representing Nadine Turner on. That was a separate matter that respondent testified Mr. Goins was not involved with. Nonetheless, respondent met with Nadine Turner, showed her the agreement, and obtained her signature to finalize the agreement. There were also several other instances where the respondent continued to practice law where there is no claim that there was other counsel involved. With Joanne Holsoppel, respondent did not advise her until 2 months after his suspension that he was suspended. At that point, he advised her, I'm still your attorney, I'm just not lead counsel. I will tell this other attorney everything to do and say. So, and in fact, she testified that Mr. Watson prepared her for a deposition in
August.
So
after his suspension, he did not become the employee of another attorney or law firm to work in a paralegal or investigator kind of role as a paid employee.
Other than the respondent's claims that he was assisting Mr. Goins, I'm unaware of any evidence to support that. There were several other instances where Mr. Watson engaged in the practice of law after a suspension. Mr. Minshall testified that he received a telephone call from Mr. Watson requesting him to call him back. The telephone message slip is in evidence in this manner and indicates Mr. Watson left a message for Mr. Minshall saying he wanted to discuss a legal matter with him. Mr. Minshall and his office mate, who overheard the conversation, another attorney, Mr. Basta, both testified that Mr. Watson called Mr. Minshall and made an inquiry about a case and represented to Mr. Minchell that he was calling Mr. Minchell on behalf of a client and called that individual a client. This was over 1 month after respondent suspension. Additionally, the day after respondent suspension, the record shows respondent contacted the two attorneys who were opposing counsel in the Angela Lockhart lawsuit. Mr. Watson called both of these attorneys in a row in a desperate attempt to settle Angela Lockhart's case because it was apparent he was suspended and he wanted to get that money before the word got out that he was suspended. He attempted to conduct bottom dollar negotiations with both of those attorneys for the city of Cleveland. The last offer approved by his client, Angela Lockhart, was $150,000. Mr. Watson lowered that to $50,000 and then lower all the way down into the single-digit $1,000 in an attempt to settle that lawsuit. That was done after he was suspended and without any of the knowledge of Ms. Lockhart or with her approval. So there are numerous instances of Mr. Watson continuing to engage in the practice of law where there was no other attorney involved that he can claim that he was assisting or working on behalf of.
At the time that you filed, that we later filed its memorandum contra, there apparently was still were fees outstanding that had not been returned. Is that still the status, as far as you know, of the fees, unreturned fees to clients?
Your Honor, in this matter, Mr. Watson collected fees from several clients. Both he would accept a retainer and also sign a contingency fee agreement. Relator attempted to have Mr. Watson provide an accounting for each of these retainers and his bank account records so that we could determine whether or not they'd been properly managed. Mr. Watson refused to provide those records. From the record, we can determine that there were several clients that paid Mr. Watson fees and received nothing in return. One primary example is Nathaniel Jones, who paid Mr. Watson $1,100. Mr. Watson did nothing for him except send him a letter with a self-addressed stamped envelope requesting more funds. And that information is in the record in this matter. At the hearing, Mr. Watson acknowledged that he took the fees, that he owed the fees to Mr. Jones, that he did no work for Mr. Jones. Nonetheless, he has not refunded that money. Another example, Donna Baltz, was hired respondent to represent her in a medical malpractice lawsuit. Respondent insisted prior to taking the case that she pay a $1,500 fee for an expert witness. The evidence in this matter shows no expert witness was ever obtained. Respondent dismissed her case on the date of the final pretrial without her knowledge or consent and refused to refund that retainer. In total, in the record in this matter, there's $8,300 in retainers and fees paid to respondent, but it is unclear what, if any, of those fees that he earned besides the two that I mentioned to you. The other large concern to relator about respondent's conduct in this matter is his pattern of deceptive and dishonest conduct. The board found that his conduct towards the disciplinary process, the hearing panel, and even his own supporters was deceitful. The board held in its decision that the respondent testified falsely at depositions relator conducted, that he provided huge amounts of false evidence during the disciplinary process, and that he testified falsely repeatedly. Additionally, respondent's prior discipline. He was first disciplined in May of 2002. In December of 2002, this court suspended him again for 2 years with 1 year stayed. When you look at all three disciplinary cases, you will see respondent has engaged in the same type of conduct throughout this entire period and violated the same disciplinary rules. The board in the first case observed that respondent has never apologized, that he's never admitted any of his actions were wrong or a violation of any rules, that he rejected all charges and claimed complete innocence. The reason why I mention that today is because that's the same thing respondent is claiming today in his third disciplinary case. Respondent not only was dishonest with his clients, he also neglected their legal matters repeatedly, engaged in prejudicial conduct, and failed to cooperate with relator during the investigation. The board found that respondent failed to keep his clients informed, failed to appear for court hearings, failed to comply with discovery requests and file responsive pleadings, failed to return unearned retainers, failed to return client files upon request, failed to cooperate in the disciplinary process, dismissed client cases without their knowledge or consent, and practiced law while under suspension. There are numerous examples of respondent doing all of those different acts. Respondent referred to several things in his opening remarks that I'd like to address. Respondent states that he has shown remorse in this matter. If you examine the board report opinion, you will see they noted the respondent expressed remorse, but the remorse he expressed was over the loss of his license and his law practice. Finally, I'd just like to say, I lost my father to cancer over the weekend, and during his illness, I spent a lot of time thinking about what it was that I learned from him. I decided the most important thing I learned from him was that you judge a man not by his words, but by his deeds. Today, I ask you to judge the respondent by his deeds. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berger. Mr. Watson, you've used your 15 minutes, but you may take 30 seconds.
I'll be just as brief as possible. Your Honor, the Turner case, as Justice O'Donnell asked about, was settled well prior to the suspension. He didn't mention that. He didn't mention that this was just a circulation of documents and nothing more that had already been executed by some of the parties well prior to the suspension. Your Honor, Ms. Holzhoppel hired Mr. Bruce Hodge. We subpoenaed him. He failed to show. I could get no cooperation to force him. I was doing all matters with regard to that. With regard to Menchel, he didn't tell you that Mr. Menchel testified that he called me. He called me, and he had confusion as to whether or not there was even a call. Please check the cross-examination. With regard to Jose Gonzalez, there absolutely was Gonzalez's specific statement that there was never at any time any reduction of demand or anything specific except conversation, which is important to pass on to the next lawyer. I reduced no offers in any kind of way, and it never said. However, when that issue came up, there was three-way conversation initiated by Ms. Barra, who has been exonerated throughout this matter, and with Ms. Lockhart on the phone to verify only whether or not I'd made such a demand or offer, which I denied. That's the only conversation.
You need to sum up, Mr. Watson.
Last statement, Judge.
Last statement.
With Mr. Jones, I never met him, had no contact with him, no information from him whatsoever until after I was suspended.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise.